Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Society Pages podcast. The Society Pages podcast is produced by the Society Pages Student Board. The Society Pages is an organization that works to bring social sciences research to you. Make sure to check us out and follow us on social media. I am your host, Chloe, and today, for our very first episode of the podcast, we have a very special guest and interview to share with you. Dr. Ruben Miller is a sociologist, criminologist, and social worker, and is currently an associate professor at the University of Chicago's Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice. Dr. Miller is also a MacArthur Genius Professor, author, and many other things. The Society Pages podcast managed to interview Dr. Miller on his new book, Halfway Home: Race, Punishment, and the Afterlife of Mass Incarceration. In his book, Dr. Miller uses his research from on-the-ground interviews with current and formerly incarcerated persons and the challenges they face from the criminal justice system and society. Racism, stigma, class, and many other realities for people involved in the criminal justice system are discussed in this episode. Dr. Miller's work is truly an exception in its exploration of the stories of those who are incarceration. Our undergraduate and graduate student interviewers, Leo, Abby, and Jake, sat down with Dr. Miller to discuss the book and the extensive research behind it. So without further ado, the Society Pages podcast is happy to present a discussion on Dr. Miller's journey with his book Halfway Home, Race, Punishment, and the Afterlife of Mass Incarceration.
Well, our first question is a bit of an elevator pitch, but could you describe your book Halfway Home in about 30 seconds or so for somebody who has not read the book?
Halfway Home is an ethnography of what I call the afterlife of mass incarceration. And what I mean by that is the lingering effects of incarceration, how it shows up in everyday life. What I tried to do in the book was take seriously that mass incarceration has transformed the social life of the city. And so Halfway Home follows people from the moment of their release, some people while they're on the inside, through jails and prisons, but also largely, you know, just back home as people try to make lives for themselves, sort of in the wake of their incarceration, but also in the wake of what is the era of mass incarceration.
And in your book, you discuss your personal background. For audience members who aren't familiar with your work, could you tell us a little bit about your journey that brought you into the fields of social work and sociology?
Sure. I started off as a volunteer chaplain at the Cook County Jail. And this was in 03. So from 03 to 08. And this, of course, is the height of mass incarceration. So you know, we arrest more people every year than we did the preceding year. We do that for about, you know, 27 years, so something close to a generation. And these years in particular are the years of its height. So 08, 07, you know, we're looking at something like 2.4 million people in an American jail or prison. And I'm right in the mix of that, doing work at the Cook County Jail, which at the time was the largest and still is the largest single site jail facility in the country. And so during this time, there were about, you know, 10,000 people on any given day in the Cook County Jail. Which, of course, there are more people in like New York City jails with an S, in L.A. County, like their jail system, but in one place, you know, one like maybe mile wide facility. There's sort of no other place in the country that holds so many people. And anyway, during that time, I was just moving through the hallways, just meeting with folks, talking to them about their lives and their experiences. You know, doing all sorts of things. I mean, the kinds of things that a chaplain does might range from talking to people about their health and well-being, you know, any distress they might have in relation to something like a pending court case, which were most of my guys, and delivering death notices. I mean, you know, so guys would be in the county, you know, which, of course, jail, you're supposed to be there for less than a year. That's what people say, at least. But, you know, I had guys that were there for 5, 6, 7, 8, 11 years, of course. And you'll see the same thing in the Twin Cities. You'll see the same thing in L.A. You'll see the same thing in New York. Of course, Kalief Browder famously was incarcerated for 3 years in jail. And so anyway, so things happen, you know, people die, people struggle with things like chronic illness and communicable disease. You know, folks have things like a high concentration of tuberculosis or HIV. Folks have heart disease. Folks have ambulatory issues. Folks struggle with their disabilities. And so you're meeting them in this time of great vulnerability. And what I was offering was spiritual counsel. I mean, you know, just talking to them about, you know, I'm a Christian guy, so talking to them about the Bible or about their relationship with God or about anything else they wanted to talk about, you know, their relationship with their families, their children. Sometimes they send me to bring a message to a grandmother. Maybe I tell them that their kid loves them, or maybe they'd send me to their son or their daughter to remind them that even though they're in a cage, you know, they're thinking about them. Anyway, so during this time, I'm just confronted with the realities of mass incarceration. I mean, I'm at this giant jail facility, and 80% of the people in that jail facility look like me. You know, I'm Black. And so I run into people who look like me, which in some ways is unsurprising. In some ways, was quite surprising. I mean, it's really quite stark. I mean, in a city that was something like a third Black, 80% of the people in that place were Black. And then I start running into my neighbors. You know, I ran into my neighbors, people I knew, people from my block, people from the buildings that I grew up in, the set of buildings, complex that I grew up in, people from my church. They would show up at my service sometimes. Or maybe I meet them in solitary confinement or maybe you know, administrative segregation or whatever. Maybe I meet them in the little cages. There was like a staging area. It was a big, giant cage where they hold men before they get processed. Maybe I'd see them there. And I needed to understand it. And so I went to school to become a social worker because I wanted to learn clinical skills to better understand what was going on. I mean, I would talk to people. I'd send them to services, you know, substance abuse treatment services. I'd refer them to counseling, and I'd see them over and over and over and over and over again. They knew all the same stuff I did. I mean, they weren't in deep need of some sort of spiritual awakening. Their grandmothers drug them to church like my grandmother told me to go to church. This is no different. They, you know, as far as counseling is concerned, they had exhausted all the routines. I'd send them to, you know, our substance abuse treatment facility, or I'd send them to our counseling service, or I'd send them to, you know, some sort of social care agency, you know, some sort of social work case manager, you know, something like that. So they had all the stuff. They had the spiritual stuff down. They had the therapeutic stuff down, you know, and they had maybe finished school, maybe not. But they keep coming back over and over and over and over and over again. And I couldn't get my head around it. So I wanted better skills to better serve them, and then got confronted with the literature on mass incarceration, which was largely written at that time by sociologists, not exclusively, but mostly sociologists were paying attention to those questions. In ways that other folks just weren't. And so then I went to get my head around it. So I did a PhD in sociology to try to study it. I changed my mind about what I wanted to do with my life. And I started working on a set of studies, first in ethnography of halfway houses in Chicago. And then eventually, when I took my first job at the University of Michigan, I followed people home from jails and police station lockup facilities in Detroit and also prisons. But anyway, about midway through doing the work for my PhD, two things happen. One thing is I meet my father, who had done about 20 years, and I just never met him. And the second was that my brother was locked up. And so I decided to think about what it meant for him, his experiences. What did it mean to have people so close to me caught up in this mesh while I was following people who were trying to care for their loved ones?
All right, now we're going to transition into questions more about the relationship between mass incarceration and institutions. What is one major misconception you think the general public has about reentry?
If we think about the reentry program as an institutional form that emerges to address the needs of people who've been locked away, I mean, halfway houses, for example, have been around forever. There are a couple of good books on halfway houses that sociologists might be interested in. One titled The Halfway House, for example. But these places have been around forever, at least as long as there have been jails or prisons, kind of way stations, places in between that are built to sort of help people make the transition out of prison and into society. But these organizations triple between the passage of welfare reform and the passage of the Second Chance Act. So between about 1996, 2008, When the country pays attention to what happens when people come home in ways that they just hadn't before. This is with the Bush administration. He started having this conversation in 2004, led largely by the Congressional Black Caucus, who started having the conversations in the early 2000s about what you do, you know, Danny K. Davis being a lead sponsor of the bill, about what you do when people come home. So many people getting locked up, so many people going away. I mean, by the year 2000, we had gone from 300,000 people inside a jail or prison in the 1970s to well over 2 million. I mean, so they're sitting there looking at this phenomenon, 95% of whom go home. And they said, let's think about pouring resources into these institutional, organizational forms, soft skills development and workforce development training and life skills training and cognitive behavioral therapy, just like all the cutting edge stuff, right? Like, so what is the cutting edge in behavioral modification? And the halfway house was the place to receive dough from the government to initiate these things. And that's wonderful. And people absolutely need it. I don't think you can be locked away for 10, 15, 20 years, even 3 or 4, even 1 or 2 without having some scars. You know, the brothers who I follow would often say, I remember one brother, he's like, you know, it's good to talk. He's talking about talking to me, though. But he's talking about it's good to talk to people. Everybody can use somebody to talk to without question. Like all of us could use somebody to talk to, especially you go through something as traumatic as being held in a cage, going from an undefined period of time if you're in jail. Shout out to Michael Walker's book, Indefinite, a beautiful book that everybody must read. So a part of the problem is the emphasis on human capital investment that has taken the nation by storm. And so I was writing about what happens in halfway houses in like academic articles that take up this question, like what is it? What is this workforce development thing that happened? You know, Gordon Laffer wrote a book called The Job Training Charade. And what he argued in that moment was that this is like the late 90s, early 2000s. And he's looking at the emergence largely through the Clinton administration, but the long sort of tail that led to the emergence of workforce training as a way for governments to try to lift people out of poverty, at least rhetorically. And what he found was that there aren't enough positions to lift people out of poverty. Mm. No, it's a sham. It's kabuki theater. It's myth and ceremony, to draw from another sociological text. And so being inspired by that work and work like that, I was looking at the emergence of workforce development, you know, kind of different from job training. And workforce placement. And what I found was that there was a lot of emphasis on the soft skills that economists think lift people out of poverty. This is a very popular community development strategy. Enhance the tenacity, trustworthiness, and grit of people. Help them with something called soft skills so they can be, quote, employable. There was so much emphasis on employability that things like actual employment placement fell by the wayside. So on the one hand, you see the rise of reentry programs that offer a form of rehabilitation that's centered on the development of soft skills, the development of people skills, the employability of the formerly incarcerated person, the employability of the ex-offender. And what we lost in the sauce somewhere was actual job placement that used to happen from inside jails and prisons in community settings. You see the decline of workforce placement services. You see the decline of things like work release programs, declining by up to 60% in some states, work release programs. You almost never hear about people leaving the prison to go to work to provide for their families. This is because of a shift in what people presume the role of the institution should be. It shifted from the social ecology of the convict, where the rehabilitative ideal was built around ideas of work and the ability of someone to provide for their family. So, surprising thing about the reentry program is that the reentry program cannot address the structural conditions that people with criminal records find themselves in. This is largely because, another technical point, but one that absolutely must be made, largely because people with criminal records are excluded from the political economy and culture. There are 44,000 laws, policies, and administrative sanctions that make sure if you have a criminal record, it's almost impossible for you to work or have a place to stay or something like that. And the reentry program, while relieving real human suffering in real time, is only able to offer temporary material support and lots and lots and lots of psychological support for what's ostensibly a material condition, a condition brought about through the person's political membership. They are excluded from full citizenship. They're excluded from full participation.
What does it mean
in the political economy
for so many people
to have been marked in this way? A paper that Sarah Shannon and her and colleagues, which include Chris Eugen, a paper they published in 2010 counted the numbers of people with felony records and found that the 19.6 million Americans that they estimated to have a felony record figure 10 times the size of the prison. 19.6. What does it mean for so many people to have had this experience? How does that show up and shape? So another myth of reentry or mass incarceration is that it's static. It happens in a place. It has a beginning and an end date. No, it is an institutional form. It is a social institution, which means it shows up and shapes other institutional forms. It's not in a bubble. It's porous and it seeps in. You know, maybe a better metaphor instead of like pores or whether or not it's in a bubble and self-contained might be like it's tentacular. It's got tentacles. You know, it moves into other social spheres and it shapes them. In powerful ways. Once we step back a little bit and we theorize what's happening, you know, starting with women. I mean, if we think about the fact that, you know, well over half, probably closer to 2/3 of the women we lock away are the primary caregivers of their children. It completely changes the game. If we think about the position of women, especially women of color, especially poor Black women, if we think about their treatment, but all women, then it starts to make sense that something like well over 80% of women that we lock away have experienced some form of violence, be it like forms of sexual predation, exposure to community violence, exposure to DV, and half of them experience that as children. Experience of incarceration, the experience of release, what it means to come home, it's just very different. In Malcolm X's words, are the most disrespected, the least protected group. He's talking about Black women specifically. Anyway, that changes the game. It completely changes the game. So for Black men, we have different sets of troubles. I mean, the Black man is the image, so says, you know, about 100 years of sociology of derision and fear. He's the object of derision and fear. He's the image. He's the boogeyman. He's the image that comes to mind when people think about things like crime and violence and stuff like that. And there are forces that are directed toward him. When I talk to my guys, the women in my sample, so I interviewed about 250 people. And I would say the majority of those folks were men, probably 75%. But I also interviewed women and some GLBTQ folks, though not a ton. When I talked to men, when was the first time they were arrested? On average, 14. And folks were telling me they were arrested as early as 10 years old. The first arrest for standing on the corner, being shorties, hanging out with each other, standing on the corner, because they are the vision of criminality, you see. And by the time they got in trouble for real, they had already been pulled over, manhandled by cops, put in the car, wrangled up, so much so that they made games out of it. You see the cop, you run. That's the game. Crack a joke, laugh. Some of these kids joined the track team, in fact, right? They made games of it. I'm thinking about one kid in particular. He was a survivor. This isn't in the book. He was a survivor of the Midnight Crew. The famous torture ring run by Captain John Burge in Chicago, who tortured false confessions out of 200 Black men in the city throughout the 80s and 90s. And so that brother told me, you know, he had a confession extracted from him through torture, a case he's still fighting, by the way. They found that the officers who had extracted the confession from him had tortured other people. And those confessions were reversed. They found that he was likely tortured, but they're trying to figure out if they can believe whether or not this brother's telling the truth. This is where things are. This is where things are. He's been fighting that case. He was in prison for a couple decades, well over 20 years. He's been fighting that case since he's been home for about five. He has a class X felony still while he fights this case. Anyway, so for men, the object of fear, black men, the object of scorn, the vision of criminality. Catherine Russell Brown says criminal black man, like as a, you know, the word is squished together, criminal black man, like it offers this social category in her work on race and crime. And so their arrest trajectories start just much earlier. And by the time they get in trouble for real. So one brother I followed for 13 years, he had been arrested many times, though cases never really stuck. Arrested 14 times, for example, for trespassing. He was homeless for a decade when he got these 14 arrests for trespassing. This is in the book. And so by the time he's finally arrested for having 3 crack rocks in his pocket during a drug sweep of the Henry Horner homes in Chicago, a famous project, the prosecutor points to his 14 arrests, which started when he was young, as evidence of his pattern of criminality. Now let's talk about arrest and incarceration for white boys. You know, so 2016, Brame and colleagues find that 49% of black boys will be arrested before they turn 23. 49%. Same study finds that 38% of white boys will be arrested before they turn 23.
And I want to pivot to another theme that we picked up from your book. So you raise the idea of recently incarcerated people as being indebted to society and to their supporters. For example, like with Jimmy's story, this comes up several times, and he describes like an upcoming marriage as being a debt, quote, "She stuck with me in prison, so I'll stick with her now." Can you explain this mindset of being indebted for favors?
Well, Jimmy, for example, in Jimmy's state, there hundreds of laws, they're like probably 40 or 50 in the state of Michigan, that restrict him from being able to access housing because of his felony record. There are probably 300 laws that prevent him from working. Liability law operates in such a way that if somebody offers him a place to stay, they can be evicted if they don't own the place. So the Drug Abuse Act of 1988 says that the person who controls the unit that a person with a record is visiting can be evicted. In fact, the 1996 State of the Union address from President Clinton said, we're going to change the rule from 3 strikes, you're out, to 1 strike and you're out. We have a new 1 strike rule in housing. And so overnight, grandmothers would be evicted for letting their grandson sleep on the couch. It's something I say in a lot of talks, but it's to me striking, powerful. So you've got all these, this formal law that hangs over your head. And then you've got liability law in the background. So on the one hand, you're an undesirable candidate to help. And on the other hand, you're made exceptionally needy. You're made needy because you're locked out. And so you need favors from people to help you. When somebody does, so that's what I call the economy of favors. You have to navigate what I call an economy of favors because you're locked out of the political economy and culture. You need people to stick their neck out for you to do you the favor of letting you sleep on the couch, employing you, et cetera. Your employment is not a matter of your qualifications anymore. It's a matter of the benevolence of the employer. All right. When somebody helps you, you are indebted to them, right? They've gone out of the way. The girlfriend has written you, has shown up for you, has been there for you, and there's nowhere else for you to go also. And so Jimmy's statement is both an expression of, I think, his actually existing feeling for this woman. I think he cares for her, but he feels he owes her. He appreciates what she did for him. And because of that, he's going to offer her intimacy. Mass incarceration seeps into even our intimacies. Like, and this is a part of the general argument of the book.
Throughout your research, it seems like you encountered a lot of people who have confronted repeated social rejection. What are some instances of resilience or coping mechanisms that you've seen these people display as a response to their rejection?
And folks are rejected at every turn in housing and employment and labor, et cetera. So I see resilience show up in people continuing to even look. I see rejection showing up in people doing things. Not rejection, but resilience showing up and people doing things that perhaps they believe may not even work for them, but they do it anyway because they have a fighting spirit. I'm going to keep looking for a job. I'm going to knock down these doors. But I also see resilience in the lives, the dynamic lives that people find and make for themselves despite all of it. So we've been talking about the gloom and doom side of things. And the gloom and doom side is really important. But people find and make dynamic lives for themselves. So, for example, I talk to brothers all the time who recount with great sadness that they've had to watch their children, quote, grow up through pictures. They do multiple rounds of incarceration, and the pictures help them to mark changes in different stages of development of their children, for example. But yo, they were able to get the pictures, you know, like this is powerful. How'd you get the pictures? How'd you maintain contact with somebody over a decade in a cage? How did you manage to make these dinners, though they're strained? They're often strained. These relationships are often quite strained, you know? But I've seen people connect with their family in ways that are strained, also in ways that are beautiful, of course. But the modal, let's think about the average. The average father who gets locked away, who doesn't see their kid for 10 or 15 years, the kid has some anger. The kid has some issues. That relationship is never quite the same, but they still manage to figure out a way to stay in their life somehow. And that to me is beautiful, powerful, awful, but also wonderful and an expression of resilience. Can you find and make a dynamic life even under these conditions? And I find that most people do. Most people do.
How do you see policymakers, employers, these institutions make it harder for people with these criminal labels to succeed? And what does success look like for these people?
Yeah, so we, you know, legal exclusion is a thing. You know, so I write about it as legal exclusion. So the laws, policies, and sanctions that prevent people with records from accessing the political economy and culture. One way that policymakers have done that is by passing 19,000 labor market restrictions to make sure that they show up in the legal and criminal codes. You know, they've done that by ensuring that 4,000 restrictions on civic participation are active in the criminal legal code. They've done that by striking well over 35, 38, something like that states. Most states in the union prevent people with felony records from sitting on a jury. Certainly from running the jury, being a senior member of the jury, you know, by restricting voting rights and stuff like that. Like, so we see it all over the place by just rejecting applications if you're an employer. And so we see it all over the place, but we also see really interesting responses and really interesting moments. You know, people have, I think, started to realize that that's not a way to make community safer. I think people are starting to realize that these kinds of initiatives in the name of crime fighting backfire. That makes people precarious, and precarity leads to more crime and more violence and more problems. At the very least, it leads to a group that's sort of struggling. And so there have been really interesting reforms across sectors. I mean, from, for example, HUD finally taking up questions of fair housing in regard to this population. So there was a memorandum that was issued by HUD last year in March that asked for HUD to think about what it meant for fair housing to extend to people with records. City of Atlanta has made people with criminal records members of a protected class. It's something I was calling for a decade ago. I was, wow, this is something that's really important and interesting, and it's been on people's radars for quite a while, and people are responding. In counties throughout the country, you know, I think local is where the action is quite often. In counties throughout the country, we see things like fair housing initiatives. So things like second chance housing. In my home county of Cook County, not only landlords and employers being now required to think with the passage of a suite of legislation, landlords and employers are required to think about hiring practices, to respond to hiring practices and hire fairly, not hiring people if the record doesn't have anything to do with the job, for example. But the credit reporting agencies are being asked to follow Illinois guidelines and the kinds of things they report in the reporting when a criminal record is pulled. The criminal record will be pulled by a landlord, let's say. The landlord doesn't get information that violates the decisions that people have made around what fair housing is. At the local level, but also at the city level, at the state level, and of course at the federal level, real movement to try to address these kinds of legal exclusions. It's the kind of thing that we absolutely need, that we need to push for.
So this next question is switching gears here a little bit. We were curious to hear if you have any like additional book, movie recommendations for students who are interested in learning a little bit more about the area that you research, like mass incarceration, criminal justice work, and sociology.
Yeah, I mean, read Michael Walker's Indefinite. It's the best book I've read in the last decade, I think, or one of the, certainly one of them. So absolutely read Professor Walker's Indefinite. Read Doing Time Together by the brilliant and wonderful Megan Comfort. There's a chapter called Papa's House that touches me every time I read it. You know, it's an ethnography of visiting in San Quentin. But really, the thing I would suggest people do, besides reading Professor Walker's book, which everybody needs to, and Dr. Comfort's book, which everybody needs to, is getting involved at the local level. I mean, you know, like find the organizations and institutions in your sector of the world that are doing important work in relation to these questions. Like it's so important to get proximate to things. So important to get close to it. It's the way we reduce fear, you know, both fear and the other, in this case, the criminalized other, the object of derision, object of disdain, the object of fear, like getting close to people who've been through the system. I mean, one in two Americans is a family member who's been locked down. You know, getting close to your own family members might be helpful, unless they're a drag. And then at that point, you know, don't do it. Like you have to have boundaries. You drag on you, I'm saying, like, you know, people who draw you in the trouble, like you got to protect yourself. I believe it. Like I'm a practical dude. Like I'm not saying that, you know, all easy roses, nobody has done anything wrong. Everybody's innocent. It's the opposite. It's the opposite. But that's the measure of the Democratic Project. Like what do you do for people you don't like? What do you do for people who've given you reason to be afraid? That's the measure of your political project. That is it. Certainly your ethical project. That is it to me. And so, you know, can you love the lovable, the unlovable? That's the question. The lovable are easy. Puppies and seals and, you know, like little fluffy things and children. Like that's all easy. You know, what do you put a dude who's giving you a reason to be afraid of him? Like that's the measure of your ethics in my mind. And so getting close, as is practical, reasonable, and safe. I'm also presuming that, you know, folks who've committed acts of violence or harm or something like that are more dangerous than anybody else. That's not my point. I'm saying, no, you don't put yourself in harm's way. I don't think you need to do that. Maybe a little bit, you know, like maybe a little bit. As you can, getting close to people and understanding the issues from people who do the work is really the most important thing here, I think.
If you are interested in learning more about Dr. Miller and his book Halfway Home, please visit www.thesocietypages.org to learn more. Next time on the Society Pages podcast, we will be talking with Natasha Waruku about her book Race at the Top, about Asian Americans and whites' pursuit of the American dream. Until next time.